I'm wondering if we can get your thoughts on your impressions when you had the opportunity to fly the Sea King helicopter, which is twice as large as the Command, and what you thought of the Canadian Navy's idea to embark these heavy helicopters on the stern of a very small destroyer when the Americans were primarily operating their helicopters off the aircraft carriers, like Brits.
Well, from my perspective, didn't delve into it too deeply at the time. I just thought it would be a very interesting project to get on and to see whether we can make it work. Now, obviously the Americans were going for small helicopters and small remotely controlled platforms to get their standoff capability. We went the other way. Size-wise, it raised your eyebrows. Yes, you see, my God, the small ship, fairly large piece of machinery, which was his too. Didn't seem to fit too well, but I think we were right in trying to find out what the problems were going to be and how this thing was going to work, whether you could make it work at all. You know, in retrospect, when you look at it, a helicopter that size on a small ship, you're spreading yourself pretty thin. You know, normally, at least in the air world, you like to have groups together, because then the maintenance problems and the supply problems and all the rest of it become fairly simple, or simplified. When you've got 14 DDHs running around, each with its own helicopter and crew, well, your problems multiply considerably.
Right. So the only opportunity that the Canadian Navy had was to keep the cost down was when the helicopters were embarked aboard the carrier. And we never had the Sea Kings on the carrier, did we? Other than for trials?
No, Bonaventure used to carry them.
But that was primarily for plane guard duties?
No.
ASW as well?
ASW, especially after the Banshees left.
The Banshees.
You were always mixing on the Bonnie. You were always mixing helicopters, fixed wing, and occasionally fighters when we had them.
So
after the fighter era went by, the Bonnie operated strictly in ASW mode, and it was trackers and Sea Kings.
Sea Kings. Do you remember how many Sea Kings would have been embarked aboard the carrier?
Never having been part of that, anywhere between 8 and 12.
So, all right, depending upon what the requirement was in the mix for aircraft.
Yeah. Make it anywhere between 6 and 12.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
Do you have any recollections of what the American Navy thought about the Canadians and trying to embark such a heavy helicopter aboard the destroyers when they have theirs in their fleet carriers, or they've got the Dash helicopters, which were the remote controlled, which were very, very small in comparison to a Sea King?
Well, I think their reaction was, "Bless you, my child, you know, wish you all the luck in the world, let us know how you make out." they supported us, and they were very interested in what we were doing, in the concepts, you know, and whether they would transfer that to their own navy or not. But they were, they were interested, and they were wishing us well, I guess.
Was that a similar reaction from the Royal Navy then as well? Because they had gone along a slightly different path as well with their harpoon and grid system,
which had
all sorts of problems.
I really had no contact with the RN during those years, so I'm really not in a position to make any statement.
All right.
So because it would only be hearsay. And,
okay. What other aircraft were you flying down at Patuxent River prior to you coming back to VX-10 in Shearwater in 1963, I believe?
It's just about everything the United States Navy had. Helicopters and fixed wing.
All right.
You know, and it was from P-3s. No, the best day I had was below sea level, going backwards at 40 knots to Mach 2 plus, you know, at 60,000 feet. You know, on four different types of airplanes.
Oh, boy. Quite the experience. So when did you return to VX-10 as a test pilot?
Basically, I went from Patuxent River, I went to VX-10 and promptly got sent down to Sikorsky to buy the CHSS-2 production.
Part of the acceptance team?
I was the acceptance pilot. And so that was all happening in 1963.
And that was for the first of, I think, four aircraft that we got from Sikorsky?
4001, 2, 3, and 4, yes.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, did you fly any of those helicopters back to Shearwater?
My recollection is that I flew the first one back, but I've been correct. And you know, I would really have to go through the logbook, but flew 4001.
All right, we can stop the tape here for a moment. So you returned to Shearwater as one of the test pilots for VX-10, and you brought 4003 back with Stretch Arnold from the U.S.
From Sikorsky.
Now, the trials with the Assiniboine start the following month, November 1963, and you were the first pilot to land aboard Assiniboine, what they call the three-deck landing, which is without the haul-down system. And Assiniboine was anchored in Bedford Basin, according to the information I have. And the weather was supposedly perfect that day. Would this be the very first time a Canadian pilot flew aboard any destroyer with the Sea King helicopter?
You've asked me a question that I really can't answer. I think it probably was, but could be wrong. You know, because there were tests done before. There were people flying S-55s.
Right. But for the Sea King, I think it was the first.
It probably was the first.
It was certainly your first.
It was my first, and it was probably the first for the Assiniboine. Now, whether Sea Kings had been taken to small decks in the United States or VX-1 or...
Right.
I have no idea, really. So, but it was my first, and nothing special about it, you know. Everything was sitting there, and we landed. And, everything seemed to fit, and, you know, you're always worried about striking the hangar with your rotor blades, but there was no real problem.
Do you have any recollection of what sort of clearance would be between the tip of your rotor blade and the hangar?
15 feet or so.
15 feet.
Well,
all right,
thereabouts, you know.
But
it's easy enough to find out.
I suppose there's a number of ways to do that, too.
Well, all you have to do is just look at the current DDH, and you know, that gives you about the same clearance. There's more than adequate clearance, in other words.
But that's a pretty small flight deck, and not very much clearance between the tip of the rotor blade and the hangar. Was there any other obstructions to be concerned about from the pilot's perspective that you remember?
Coming aboard, not really. No, because you always came in from a quarter. And so you sort of crept up on the tail end of the ship, which is quite clear of obstructions. Had to be, of course. You know, so the first major obstruction you had was the hangar. You know.
I've heard some people comment that there was a mast on top of the hangar too that was removed and placed in a different location, and that came out of the Assiniboine trials. Do you have a recollection of that?
Not really, but it's quite possible, you know, because it probably was up there and it was just added height made the clearance, rotor clearance, that much tougher. In other words, you have to consider your rotor not only for the height of the hangar, but the mast on top of the hangar. So, yes, it made sense, and it made no difference to the ship where it was put.
Right.
You know, and as a matter of fact, nowadays, they've got the mast up there with all kinds of things hanging from it, your gyro horizons and all that good stuff, so it's right back up there.
was an LSO aboard the ship when you made that first deck landing in Bedford Basin?
Yeah, Jerry Moore was there, and he was observing, and we were in radio contact, and we talked back and forth on how things looked. But, whether it was directing like an LSO, like a standard LSO, no, it wasn't that way.
All right.
You're looking good, yeah.
Who was in the seat beside you? Was that Stretch Arnold? Do you remember?
It was either Stretch or Zbigniew.
All right.
But
I'll stop there. So the co-pilot during that first deck landing was?
Larry Zbigniew.
Larry Zbigniew.
Well, of course, he's a very experienced helicopter pilot, so.
Now
he would have kept me out of trouble no matter what I did.
Now, that was a free deck landing without the haul down and winch system and the bear trap. Do you have any recollections of aircraft handlers being aboard the deck to lash the aircraft down and use the chocks?
No, that came after the landing, of course.
Right.
And it's pretty standard. But I think in that one, we just did a touchdown. We may have shut down, but the ship was not moving. It was at anchor.
Right.
So, there's no need to lash things down. You chalk it. Chalking is automatic. You chalk everything.
Right.
But that would be about the extent of it. We probably shut down, had a look, took off, and went home and thought about it.
Now, did they, do you remember traversing the helicopter into the hangar during these very early trials in Bedford Basin just to see about the fit?
Oh, once we got the bear trap operating, yes, of course, that was part of the trials, Land, shut down, fold everything, and,
traverse it into the hangar.
Traverse it into the hangar and see what problems you have. And we had problems.
That was a very small or very tight fit with the
seat. It was a tight fit, and the tail... the way the tailwheel acted needed some modification.
It didn't have the folding capability at this point in time?
No. The tail folded, but the tailwheel.
Oh, right, okay.
Around.
For the tail guiding winch system
that
comes later.
Yeah.
All right. I understand that the early trials in Bedford Basin lasted for about a week's time, and there was a number of free deck landings, but you didn't actually fly the wire to the deck of Assiniboine until somewhat later during the trials. Is that correct?
That is correct, because the haul down system was having its own problems.
Do you have a date in your log from when you first made the haul down landing?
First haul down? No, I don't.
No? All right. I'm wondering if you can speak about that experience, though, or any of the subsequent landings using the fall down and bear trap system.
Yeah.
Was it a different sensation to be hooked up and hauled down?
Well, one thing it did, as it turned out, tension on the haul down cable gave you a centering force, which tended to, as long as you kept the helicopter level, it tended to pull you into the center. So that was helpful. you had to be fairly careful of how you landed, because even now we're breaking landing gear, because they're robust, but they're not that robust. So you had to be careful of your rate of descent, and you still do. Other than that, it was an exercise in precision flying, really. You have to try and keep yourself centered above the flight deck. The LSO would be helping, and he could probably judge ship motion a bit better than the pilot, and he'd tell you, he said, okay, stand by, because it looks like things are going to quieten down. You know, and it became a team effort, really, and he'd slam some more tension on you, you'd lower the collective a little bit and thunk her down.
Now, the rate of descent, is that primarily determined by the winch?
No.
And the haul down, or is it a combination of that as
no.
well as what the pilot
no,
is doing?
The helicopter had enough lift capability that I could have yarded out, you know, even under full tension, I could have yarded out all the wire on the winch.
Oh, really?
Of course.
Okay, I was unaware of that.
Yeah, no, it hadn't, you know. You're, basically, all you're doing is adding weight, really, to the same as adding weight to the helicopter. You
know? All right.
You were never near all of weight.
Okay.
To begin with.
So. All right. When you were doing some of these early trials aboard Assiniboine and Annapolis, how high off the deck were you while you were being hooked up and prior to being hauled down and
well,
secured into the bear trap?
Prudence declares that you were high enough to clear the rotor head from the hangar, just in case you do something stupid. So
would that be about 20 or 30 feet then,
yeah.
on average?
Yeah, well, whatever the height of the hangar is, about 18 feet.
All right. So
whatever, you know, and you know, you just hover there to. In a comfortable position, or as comfortable as you possibly could get, until the hookup and all the rest of the thing was accomplished. You know, and you took it from there. Then you probably lower yourself to about halfway, being very conscious of the hangar right in front of you.
Right.
You know, and then you just wait for things to settle down.
Now, as the pilot, is your attention focused not only upon your instruments, but the LSO and the tips of your rotor blades to the hangar?
Well, the LSO, you got to remember, was hidden in a howdah. You couldn't see him anyhow.
All right.
You know, so it wasn't a standard LSO like you think of on a carrier, a guy with paddles. And
right.
And stuff. But what you were mostly conscious of is ship's motion, you know, relative to you, or you relative to it, try and make sure that you never got into a pilot-induced oscillation or got out of sync, so to speak. And basically, what you're trying to do is keep the helicopter stable in space. In other words, keep it in one position, let everything happen around it. And all you really could see was the hangar.
All right.
And of course, on your peripheral vision, you've got the nets and the water. And, you know.
Now, would it be accurate to say that your co-pilot is also providing additional information for you, another set of eyes as it relates to clearances?
That's right.
Depending upon your particular procedures, I know everybody has a different way of doing things, but
no. Again, it was team effort. You know, the pilot did. The flying, most of the flying, the co-pilot handled the systems and power and kept his eye on the instruments and, you know, make sure that everything was going correctly. And he did all the radio work, of course.
All right. Now, depending upon circumstances or conditions primarily, sea conditions and wind, would there be times when you could be in the hovering position hooked up to the wire but waiting for that lull, waiting for the LSO to determine when the lull is and you're brought to the deck? That could vary from seconds to...
To minutes? Oh, yeah. No, that's standard. That's what you look for. You know, And again, the captain of the ship has a lot to do with it too. It just depends on how he drives it, you know, whether he realizes what's going on back there, and whether he tries to position his ship in such a way that it rolls the least, you know, and this kind of thing. But yes, you can sit there, you know, and wait for it, and wait for it, and wait for it.
Now, would I'm sure that that's not the situation that you'd like to find yourself in. I'm sure you'd like to be on the deck and secured into the bear trap as soon as possible.
Yes.
So a very tense time. And these are very early days, too. I mean, everybody that's involved with this project is first kick at the cat, so to speak. There is, it's a little bit of trial and error. Everybody's very knowledgeable in their particular area. But you're sort of setting the standard and writing the book at the same time.
Yes.
So there was a lot that was unknown, I assume. I mean, this is the first of all the trials.
Yes, but interaction between helicopter and ship is a bit of an unknown, but turned out to be nothing spectacularly different than what had been experienced before in earlier trials. Scale was upped a bit, you know. Some of it was helpful, some of it was not. But it was interesting. And when the weather got rough, or at night, or low visibility, then your skills were brought out, and, you know, taught you how to fly precision.
Yeah, there's a big difference between Bedford Basin and out doing trials off of Halifax in rough weather or night trials, especially as it relates to clearances and the relationship between the tip of the rotor blade to the
hangar. And also what you see, what you know, because you lose, of course, peripheral vision.
Right. No point of reference.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, between the hookup and the haul down, once the LSO had made the decision to actually haul the aircraft to the bear trap and secure it in place, we're talking a matter of seconds here, are we?
Yeah, you know, very, very short time period, you know, and he says, okay, now is the time you lower your collective, and basically you just take a little bit of lift off the rotor and down you come. And as I said, you have to be careful that you don't come down too fast or you're going to break landing gear.
But even if you didn't come down too quickly, I assume, not knowing what the sensation feels like, that it would be a bit of a thump onto the deck.
You had to be positive. Now, you couldn't fool around with it. You couldn't be half hover, half this, because first of all, bear trap is only 4 feet square.
Right.
You know, and there is enough motion inherent in the beast, you know, that you could get the probe out of the trap without even trying.
Oh, really?
Well, all you have to do is lift it about a foot.
And it's disengaged from the trap.
Well, you could have it outside the trap.
Oh, all right.
Area.
Okay.
You know, depending. But yes, no, it was a precision maneuver, and it was positive. You have to be very positive about it. And once you touch down, you're down.
All right. At what sort of altitude would you lose sight of the deck and the bear trap because of the...
You never saw the bear trap. It was 15 feet behind you or whatever.
All right. So the only time you would see it would be during the approach then?
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Now, yeah. The angle of approach varied depending upon conditions. Would that be true?
Yes, whatever you felt comfortable with and where the wind was coming from.
Okay.
You know, so, because there was some burble, of course, off the hangar and off the ship, you know, and it would tend to toss you around a little.
Now, would that turbulence be from not only around the superstructure of the hangar, but from the funnels themselves as well?
Well, you try to avoid that.
All right.
You know, that was very early in the game, you know, that's why you always came in on the quarter.
On the quarter, okay.
You know, because you don't want to be sucking down stack gas.
Right, okay. And and that could present all sorts of problems, I assume.
Oh, boy.
Now, did the split funnel on the Saint Laurent class, that add additional problems?
No.
No?
No, because you always had enough wind at such coming across at such an angle that it carried all that stuff clear.
All right. Yeah. Would that be about 15 degrees?
Whatever it took.
You know, all right.
15, 20 degrees.
I've had someone comment that one of the things that came out of the Assiniboine trials was that they had to extend the height of the funnels for the benefit of helicopter operations. Do you have any recollection of that? And the funnels were split when Assiniboine was in for her conversion at Victoria Machinery Depot,
yeah.
But somebody said that the funnels were extended. I've seen nothing in the paper, but
no, I haven't either. No, I can't. Well, certainly, I don't think they were extended when I was doing the flying around it.
All right.
You know, so whether they were extended afterwards or before even she came over, that could be.
That could be, all right.
Because people were thinking about, you know, you're sitting back there and stack gas is not very nice stuff to breathe.
And if I'm not a pilot, so perhaps you could speak to some of the other problems that are associated with the exhaust from a flying perspective.
Well, you know, turbulence is one, but the seeking was heavy enough that it could handle it, but it tended to bounce you around a bit. But the big thing is that you're breathing CO2 or carbon monoxide, or you're breathing the product of burning of oil,
right?
You know, and it's sulfur and all that other good stuff.
Not very pleasant.
Not only pleasant, but it's not very healthy either. So.
Right.
But the biggest problem from a pilot point of view, of course, was turbulence and trying to keep the helicopter still in the air relative to the ship. Let the ship do whatever it wants to do under you. Natural tendency would be to follow the ship. If you see, the hangar rolling from left to right and at 18 feet above the deck, and that was probably another 20 feet or so above the waterline, it describes quite an arc, you know, and your
right.
Natural tendency is to
follow the ship.
Right.
Instead of maintaining level flight.
Right.
Now, one of the other things, you're talking about roll here. What about the ship vertically lifting in certain states?
Well, that's what you had an LSO for, you know. He says, okay, that was part of the not only roll, but he had to judge, you know, when to come down in such a way that if the ship was dropping away from you, that wasn't too bad.
But if it's coming up, that's another thing.
That was another thing, because then you combined, you know, you might combine your rate of descent with the ship coming up under you just might be enough to crack the landing gear. So.
All right.
So you have to be aware of that too.
Now, if you're hovering above the ship coming in to drop the messenger cable and the haul down cable being brought up and then hauled down, is it more dangerous from the pilot's perspective with the ship lifting vertically while you're not hooked up?
No.
No?
No, you're well clear.
All right.
No, there is no problem that way. No, the problem comes on landing.
On the landing.
Yeah.
So prior to dropping the messenger cable, are you maybe 40 feet above the deck then? So that if the ship is lifting vertically, that the two don't...
Whatever is comfortable.
Whatever is comfortable. Okay.
You know, and as long as your rotor blades are clear of the hangar, you know, so whatever... It will vary with each pilot, I'm sure.
Right.
But whatever you feel comfortable with, whatever height you feel comfortable at, you just stay there. You know, you have to make sure that when you drop the messenger, that at least somebody down there can catch it.
Yeah, that would be another problem. During these different sea states, if you're maintaining your hover prior to dropping the messenger cable, and the ship is lifting vertically, and the distance between the helicopter and the ship is now decreased by 10 feet or 20 feet or whatever the case may be, and you're receiving that information, there must be a certain amount of lag time between that information being communicated to you from the LSO, for example, and you as a pilot being able to react to those changes.
Well, if you're talking about the critical part, which is the landing itself, yeah. In the hover, no. You know, in the hover doesn't matter. You know, the ship can do whatever it wants to. You know, if the back end is lifting by 20 feet, well, you got other problems then. You know. whether you should be out there at all is the question.
Right. Well, now...
But vertical motion really comes into play when you finally make your decision to land.
All right.
And then it can be critical, but that's between you and the LSO.
All right.
You know, it's a matter of technique, you know, and it's something you learn. You know, I say, okay, how much do I actually lower the collective now, you know, to get a reasonable rate of descent?
And that vary depending upon the pilot and the conditions?
And yeah, your technique, but, the thing was to be positive. You know, I said, once you start down...
That's it.
Come on down.
All right, we'll just stop the tape here and put in another one.